We're here tonight because of Tuesday evenings, and as I think many of you know, Tuesday evenings is an ongoing lecture series here at the Modern that 10 lectures in the fall and 10 in the spring. I'm Terry Thornton, and it's one of my favorite parts of my job here at the Modern is to introduce the speakers and to participate in this program. We have tonight's the opening of the fall series, of course, and I'm really glad to be back, and I appreciate all of you. We're starting slightly early this season. I mean, not really. We always start that first Tuesday after Labor Day, but this year it came really early. So it's a little early by some people's calendar, but I'm glad to be back. In the swing of things, we have a really good lineup that you can find on the website or that you can pick up a schedule card at the information desk to check it out. Next week we have Paul Slocum here, and Paul is known for his art, music, and the Andor Gallery in Dallas. Some of you are familiar with him, and all of you, I assure you, want to be. So come back next week and he'll talk about all of that. And then following him on the 16th is Richard Wentworth, who will be here from London. One of my all-time favorite artists, who I assure you will entertain. He is featured as one of three artists in the current exhibition at, let me get this right, Fort Worth Contemporary Arts at TCU, which is the new gallery there in the exhibition Uncommon Sense. And I encourage you to go see that exhibition and then to be here on the 16th as well as next week on the 9th to see Paul Slocum. Now, tonight we open with a very thoughtful artist who has maintained a passion and curiosity over three decades, decades visually and physically manifesting fresh ideas that question boundaries and explore the world we live in. A veteran of the West Coast art scene, Robert Wilhite lives and works in Venice, California, where he has basically been stationed with a few interludes to New York, Japan, and Europe through the years since his graduating in 1970 with a BA from UC Irvine, where he where he studied with the likes of Robert Irwin and Larry Bell and others, and worked toward his MFA, which he completed at California State University in Northridge. His education prepared him to challenge the conceptual and formal parameters of art, which has resulted in an array of beautiful and compelling theater and art performances, objects, set designs, installations, drawings, paintings, and music of various sorts that have won Robert much deserved recognition with three NEA grants and exhibitions that span the globe. Most recently, he showed The Bomb at Barry Whistler Gallery in Dallas, where it received a great deal of critical acclaim. The 135-pound wooden replica of Fat Man, the bomb, as you know, that was dropped on Nagasaki, Japan, in World War II, was described in an article on Robert and the piece in the LA Times as more of a thing of beauty than an instrument of horror. The Bomb is Robert's most recent exploration, and I do believe that every endeavor takes him deep into a world of research and investigation of his subject and everything that that implies. But tonight he broadens the scope as he shares the patient and persistent practice that he's seen through that has brought him to the bomb and will take him who knows where in his presentation, Art as Art. So please join me in giving a warm welcome to Robert Wilhite.
Thank you very much for everyone for coming tonight. And I'm not a Texas artist, but I got here as fast as I could, as Barry told me. Terry asked me, when she asked me if I was interested in giving a lecture, what it should be about. And so I said, art of the art. And It's like, what does that mean? And so I wanted to explain that when I started making art, I came from a background. My family, art was not a part of, my life growing up. And I never went to museums or anything. And when I started going to school at Irvine, I wasn't in the art department. And then when I started taking classes from the likes of Robert Irwin and Larry Bell and those people, I started thinking about art. And once I started thinking about it, it was like this habit that I couldn't let go of. I mean, and I think it's true of most artists. Once you leap into the pool, it's pretty hard to get out, and it's pretty hard to stop thinking about all of the aspects of art. But to begin with, I didn't know what art was. And so part of my search as an artist in my career has been to try to figure out what it might be. And in doing so, I've tried to set up situations, make art pieces, do all kinds of things that, try to accomplish things around an object. I've always considered myself a sculptor more than a painter, pretty much because of the fact that I could never see a painting as not an object. I couldn't just deal with the front surface and let go of it. I had to deal with it as an object. So anyway, let me get to my first slide and start. The first piece I'm going to show you is a piece that I titled Empire State Glider. And I was living in New York. After I got out of Irvine, I moved to, New York and worked at Pace Gallery. And it was a place where most of my teachers showed. And so it gave me an opportunity to see them in a different light, and also to meet a number of artists that I wouldn't have met otherwise. People like Lucas Samaras and Louise Nevelson, and painters like Alfred Jensen. And it opened up another element of, art to me that I hadn't seen before. But with this piece, I made a glider, and I took it to the Empire State Building. And first thing Sunday morning, I was one of the first people up in the elevator. It was during the winter. It was really cold. I put the piece together. Most of the guards at the time were inside. And I tried to fly it off the Empire State Building. And the first time I flew it, it went up and hit the building and came right back down to where I was standing. And so I picked it up and straightened the wings and threw it off again a little harder, and it did the same thing, except this time it missed the little fence and just flew off. And if you look in this picture, right here is the glider. And it, and there it is as well in the smoke. And it flew 26 blocks before hitting a taxi cab. And that's the taxi cab driver in the center, and me on the right, and a friend of mine on my left. And I started with the piece wondering if I put the object through an extraordinary feat, would that make it art? And so I did this thing. It hit the taxi cab, and the taxi cab driver had been a photographer in the Korean War. And he said that when he first saw it, he didn't know how big it was. And his initial reaction was that we were being invaded. And he didn't know how big it was until it hit his car, which I found fascinating, because it dealt with that whole scale thing. And so after the piece, I love the glider, but the story was really an important part of it too. And so in my search, I thought a lot about whether the story was really a necessary part of it. The next pieces I'm going to show you, I always had a hard time with the hierarchy of art, and I've made a number of works that are furniture and functional pieces. And I've always felt that if an object can capture your interest and draw you to it, it I don't know whether it's essential for it to be, quote, fine art or decorative arts. It's whether an object has a certain power. And in the early 90s, after a conversation I had with a fellow named Kenny Price, we talked about whether art, that ephemeral aspect of art, could be contained in an object that was mass-produced. And Kenny Price is a ceramicist, and he's had some opportunities to have some things produced. And he backed out at the last minute every time. And he said that he backed out because he felt that element of art couldn't be accomplished in something that would be mass-produced. And I said, I don't know if that's true. I think you can do it if you really continue to focus on the details. And so I had an art show in Los Angeles, and I had met a fellow there that had trained as a silversmith in England. And I had him fabricate 9 5-piece play settings for me that were what I considered to be constructivist. And I loved them. I thought that they turned out really good. And they were in response to the time that I was at Pace Gallery, and one of the owners came back from an auction in London with a complete set of flatware designed by a fellow named Puificat from France. And when I saw the flatware, I thought, wow, this can be art too. So when I met this fellow, I designed this flatware and made 8 pieces. And then about a year or so later, I got very sick, and I didn't know whether I was going to be able to continue making furniture or art or anything. And so I looked into producing the flatware. And these are the 3 sets of flatware that I designed and had fabricated in Japan and sold throughout the country through all of the department stores. I wanted to see if I could make something with a contemporary aesthetic and inject it into the mainstream and have it see what would happen. I think that part of art is to throw it out there and see what kind of response you get. The first two pieces are salad sets. This is a salad set for the second set that I designed. These are the serving pieces for that same set. And they're asymmetrical. This is the third 5-piece play setting that I designed, and it was my attempt at something classical. And this is the second set. And this set is called XL. And this set is called Zoom. And both of those titles are three-letter words that I took from some poetry by a fellow named Klebnikov, who was a Russian futurist. And the futurist movement has been something I've always been perplexed by and interested in. And both the Russian aesthetic of that time period, the avant-garde, artists, as well as the Italians. And for a long time, I struggled to understand the difference between the Russian futurists and the Italians. And I read books, I looked at the art, I tried to figure it out, and it led to my later work. But one of the things about the Italian futurists was that, oops, sorry. The Italian futurists believed that the way to the future, or the future, was going to be a utopia, but it was only to be accomplished through speed, technology, violence, and fascism. And the Russians, there was a big turmoil between Marinetti and Khlebnikov. And Khlebnikov was a poet that had a major influence on people like Tatlin and Elisitsky and Malevich. And the difference was that from my readings, and I didn't get this from a number of the books that I read, but I believe it to be true, is that the Russians felt that the future was going to be a utopia, but the way to it was through an embrace of technology, but also a reverse and a focus on the roots of the Slav language and culture. And I found myself one time at the Detroit Institute of the Arts walking through with the director, and I saw a Malevich painting on the wall, and it was a simple gouache of a peasant in the field. And I asked the director, how can this be? How can Malevich, who did paintings like the White Square and the Black Square, be painting this painting of like a Russian peasant in the field? And he said, well, you know, it's hard to keep doing the same thing, which wasn't the right answer. I think that the right answer was that Malevich was consistent to the futurist idea by painting peasants in the field in a very simple manner. I mean, that's my interpretation. But futurism is something that I've thought about, and as well as the really powerful visual vocabulary of those artists. I wanted to move to next to... to these. This is a painting by Dubuffet, and it's an Art Brut piece. And I saw it when I lived in New York, and I never forgot it. The ground is stained dirt, and the butterfly wings compose the figure. And I thought about it, and I thought about it, and I thought about what he was doing. He was taking two extremes and putting them together, the delicate wings of the butterflies and the dirt. And I thought, well, what if you combine delicacy with concept? And where does that take you? And what about if you combine completely varied materials, and what happens? And so in my search for what art is, these are some pieces that I ended up making. These are gliders. They're dragonfly wings, and there is a tail on the glider that it's hard to see. And that little round object is a pinhead, a round map pinhead that goes through the ebony stick. And I I had been collecting butterfly and dragonfly wings for about, I don't know, 15 years, and using them in various pieces. And I started making these pieces, and I found them, I see them as a sort of neo-futurist object, in that they're a combination of something as basic as insect wings and insect flight, with it's combined with the basic technology that the Wright brothers brought us. These are all different types of dragonfly wings, and they're all natural. I haven't done anything to them. I made the frame for this piece. It's copper and gold leaf around the center hole. And after seeing those Dubuffet pieces, or the pieces I saw in New York, I'd always thought about trying my hand at doing some little portraits. And so this piece is titled Sultan. And this is a self-portrait. At the time I did it, I had a beard. And these pieces are about, they're small, and about 4 inches by 6 inches. And so they're intimate. And a lot of my work is fairly small and intimate. And I've always felt that a piece should be able to have an energy that draws you to it. And it's something that I've consciously been aware of. This piece is called Svengali. And this is an exhibition of models that I made that were my contemporary reflections of the seven wonders of the ancient world. This exhibition was in Bergamot Station. This slide is from the Barry Whistler Gallery, and it wasn't just the Seven Wonders, but it included the Sword of Damocles as well. These pieces are wooden framed with a paper skin, and most of them are painted with lacquer as a sealer over the paper skin to give it a little bit of strength. But the Sputnik, I felt, was a contemporary reflection of the Colossus of Rhodes, in that the original Colossus was supposed to have spanned the harbor in Rhodes, but they're not sure of that. The historians that I talk to, my ex-wife is a painting conservator, and I have a number of friends at the Getty. So I talked to them about the Seven Wonders, and there's a lot of questions about them. They weren't sure whether the Colossus actually stood beside it or across it, but they know that it actually was created, and it was created in a manner where those artists never duplicated that skill again. It was a one-time thing where they rose to the occasion. There were supposedly stones in various parts of this sculpture to give it balance or to give it strength or something, but I was told that there were stones in it, and how they know it existed is that after 50 years it fell over in the harbor, part in the harbor and out of the harbor, and it laid there for quite a while, and they have records of the Syrian trader that came and bought it and hauled it off, and they have records of how many cartloads of bronze there was. So I find that interesting. This is a crescent moon, and I made it to refer to the temple of Artemis at Ephesus. The temple was in honor of about women, and it's where the Amazons were, and it was a temple that was eventually burned down and destroyed. And I chose this piece, a crescent moon, because a moon is the lunar symbol is representative of women, and also in this day and age, it's also reflective of the Islamic world, which I felt was pertinent. And again, it's lacquer on wood and tissue paper over a wooden frame. This is the throne of Zeus. The statue of Zeus was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, and it was actually carved ivory over a wooden frame, and the statue was huge, and at the end of the great hall, and it was overscaled so that if Zeus would have stood up, he would have gone through the roof, but and then the throne itself was supposedly ebony and encrusted with jewels and gold. And as time went on and the gods changed, the whole sculpture and the temple fell in disarray and was eventually just looted. And there's nothing left. But I chose making a chair. Like this, it's again paper that I stained with Sumi ink, and it's a very light wooden frame, and it's held on the wall with magnets. And I tried to exhibit the piece high on the wall, and just the chair, because I felt like in this day and age there are a number of gods that seem to be vying for the seat on the throne. This is a boat that is representing the pyramid at Giza, the Great Pyramid. I always saw the pyramids as transportation for the pharaoh to the afterlife. And the boat seemed like the best form for that. And also I became really interested when I found out that next to the Big Pyramid, in 1975, a French archaeologist discovered two pits that contained solar boats for the pharaoh. And they opened one, and they found everything in perfect shape except for the ropes. And they put it together, and you're able to view that these days. And the other pit, they drilled a little hole and ran a fiber optic into it so that they could see if indeed there was another boat there, and there was, and it's in perfect shape. But there was a big controversy as to whether they should open these things or not, whether the elements would help destroy them. But they opened one and left the other one closed. And one of the boats was for the pharaoh to be able to go upstream in, and with a sail, you know, and the other one was for going downstream with oars. And all of these pieces, I drew out the plans on my wall or on my floor, and then figured out how to make it, and then proceeded from there. This is the piece that it's a lighthouse, and it's reflective of the pharaohs at Alexandria. And the lighthouse I found to be a very interesting piece. It was this marble lighthouse, really tall, and the light itself, I think, had a reflective mirror behind it. And the Egyptians used gold for their mirrors, and I think that there at one time there was a mirror of gold. But I asked my friends at the Getty, "What was the light? What was the light? You know, what did they use to burn?" And they didn't know. So the consensus is that it was either dung or this tarry pitch that they used in those days. But as far as the light itself, it's not really known what it is. But this piece, I wanted the house to look like it was super light, and it just lifted off the floor, and it was contained in the room by the roof. This is the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, and the original Hanging Gardens, they're not really sure was even in Babylon. They think that possibly it could have been somewhere else, but it was an engineering feat. It was a garden on the top of a building that supported trees that were many feet in diameter, and a complete garden, and it was created for the queen, who supposedly was from a place that had forests and a lot of vegetation. And the king created the garden for her so that she could feel at home. And so, when I made this piece, I kept thinking about waking up in a room with the garden kind of going up, so that, like those swimming pools that kind of disappear into the ocean, that possibly looking out of her room, she just saw the garden, and it eclipsed all of the other stuff going on around her. Whether that's true or not remains to be seen. I saw the engineering feat of putting a garden on the top of a building is not that big a deal these days. And I found it more impressive, the idea that there could be a billboard on the top of a building that was an exact image of something that was maybe 50 feet by 30 feet. And so with this piece, I created the billboard on the top as both an advertising thing and also an example of a technology that was contemporary. This piece is my interpretation of the mausoleum at Halicarnassus. And the mausoleum was created by the major artists of the day. It was adorned with sculptures, friezes that were unbelievable. And the roof on the top of the building was a chariot with, I believe, three or four horses. And it was unbelievably beautiful. And the actual sarcophagus was, I think, either gold or some sort of precious stone. It was a marvel, and the mausoleum was looted, and all of the marble was eventually taken from it, and a fort was created in the middle of the city. It's now the city of Bodrum, and the fort still exists in the middle of the harbor, and the marble is the same marble that was used on the mausoleum. I chose a rocket for the mausoleum because it seems that today a lot of people are choosing to send their remains to outer space. And a number of Koreans are doing it. There have been a number of Americans that have done it. And so rather than having the artwork adorned by artists, the engineers and the scientists that can enable something to be sent to outer space, I feel is a very important feat. So that's why I interpreted it this way. And the gold cube in the piece is a cube that I made. It's made out of very thin, a 16th of an inch plywood that with mitered corners and stuck together to represent the container. And my father died that same year, and so there's a photograph of him in this piece. In 1985, I was asked to go to Washington, D.C. and be involved in a project with an artist named David Ireland. And while I was there, I walked by the Ford Theater, and it was open, and I went in, and I found it an amazing experience because the whole situation about Lincoln became real. I saw the theater. I saw the box where Lincoln was. I was astounded. I said, whoa, there it is. And I could see how John Wilkes Booth could jump onto the stage and get away. And it was just high enough that if he landed wrong, he could break his leg, which he did. And it became a real thing for me. Before it had been a story and as part of my life and my education, but it hadn't really been real. And I saw a sign while I was there that said that there was a museum in the basement, and so I went into the basement and looked around, and I noticed that in a corner there was a pin light coming down on a little case. And I walked over to the case, and lo and behold, there was this Derringer, and it's the Derringer that was used by John Wilkes Booth to shoot Lincoln. And I have to admit that when I saw it, I just kind of backed up a little bit because it had this power, and I'd never thought about that object before. And I know that guns are something else, but this piece had an energy that was greater than it. And it made me think about how do you get that energy in a piece of art? How do you do it? Or not that this is a piece of art, but it's an object. And that's something that I've thought about for a long time. And I had a friend in California that had a collection of Plains Indian shaman power bundles, and they enabled the owners of the bundles to be invisible on a raid and steal horses or be invincible in battle. And they ranged from adorned skulls to pipes to special stones that they might have seen on a vision quest and gone to a place that they had or hadn't been before and found this object. And there were rituals based around these things. And I went and saw these bundles that this fellow had. And I was raised in a conservative house in Southern California. And the whole idea of objects having a power was just, it seemed absurd to me. And yet, when I was looking at these things, I felt like I was in the presence of something else. I felt like I couldn't breathe, and I was being compressed. And I had never felt that before. And I, after looking at three or four of them, I said, I can't look at it anymore. I can't do this anymore. And I left the room. And a little while later, a couple months later, I talked with a curator friend of mine at the Oakland Museum, and I said, you know, this funny thing happened to me. I'd seen these things, and they had this effect on me. And I'd always felt that maybe you brought it to the party, you know? But these things really had an energy and a power that went way beyond the you know, what they were. And I wondered how you do that. And that's something that I've been searching for and trying to explore. And in that search, it led me to thinking about, well, what if you take, instead of trying to inject the object with that energy, what about if you take an object that has a certain amount of power, which led me to making this piece, which is my interpretation of the Fat Man bomb. And it, I talked with Barry about it roughly 2 years ago, and about, I don't know, 8 months ago, maybe a little longer, he said, listen, if you want to make the bomb, I'd like to show it. And I said, okay, you're on. And I started making the bomb, and I went to the Atomic Energy Museum in Albuquerque, and I measured the carcass of the Fat Man bomb, and I brought it back to my studio and the small drawing, and I laid out paper on the floor of my studio, and I drew the silhouette of the piece, and then looked at it for about another month and a half to try to figure out how in the world am I going to make this. I wanted to make it out of wood, and originally I was going to cover it with paper like the other pieces. And the more I thought about it, the more I decided that it should not be covered with paper, because by leaving it open and leaving it as a structure, that I could have more visual references in making the piece. So this piece, I found myself making aesthetic decisions about, which I found very interesting. I kept thinking, wow, I'm making aesthetic decisions about really an object that I feel is one of the darkest objects in the world, this horrible thing. And then it led me to think about the original design of the bomb, and that there had to have been someone in a room somewhere that drew it in the first place, and was responsible for the aesthetic elements of the bomb, which I found to be very interesting. I mean, yes, we know who flew the plane, we know what it looked like, we know who designed it, how they designed it, what they used, what it did, and everything else. But I found thinking about the aesthetic elements of this to be a real contradiction. And it is, in a way, consistent with my thoughts of combining opposites and extremes. And so with this piece, I wanted it to go from being solid from one view to being transparent as well. And the bulkheads, I wanted it to appear very light, and like it could be, if a strong wind came in, it could be blown away. And the original piece was in this size, 10 feet, 8 inches, 10,800 pounds. So this piece turned out to be somewhere around, I don't know, somewhere between 120 and 150 pounds. So I was happy about that. I made it intentionally in kind of the balsa wood frame method with bulkheads, because I wanted it to be made in an antiquated style, a style of models that was typical to the period. Today, if you're going to make a model, most of the time, model planes are made out of foam, and a lot of the planes are made like surfboards so that they can be light, still have the strength. But I chose to make it this way. It's made in three parts. It's entirely made out of wood, except for what few screws are in it and the bent antennas. And I painted it black because I didn't want any of the details of the wood to overpower it. I didn't want any of the details to distract from it. And this piece, I completed it roughly 3 months ago. I cut out the parts for a month and a half, almost 2 months, before I was able to start putting it together and even start to realize where I'd made mistakes. And it took me about a month and a half to put it together. And it completely came down to the wire of being able to get it done and get it to Dallas and up for the exhibit. But my son and I put it in a truck and drove it to Dallas, and the front end of the truck was out of alignment, and the thing shook and came apart, and we had to stick it back together again. In Arizona, it took us about 3 hours to put it together, and then we had to do it again when we got to Dallas. But it was completed and done. But in the 2 months since I've done it, I have had, I mean, just in California alone, a local newspaper ran a front page story about it. The LA Times ran a story about it, a front page story in one of their sections. It was in an online magazine here in Texas, The Glass Tire. And it there was an article in the Boston Globe, and it was also there was an interview that I gave with a television studio in Los Angeles, and also there was an interview with a radio station in Japan. And it was all of that's happened in the last 2 months over this piece. And it is very funny how the person that wrote the article for the Los Angeles Times said, "This is not an art review. This is a news story." And when it was picked up by the Boston Globe, they changed the title of the article, and they said that this piece was really confrontational, and that it had horrified a number of the people that had come to the gallery, and it was really a controversial thing. And so the Japanese radio station that contacted me they couldn't believe that I would make such a piece. And they sent me a number of questions in advance and asked me how I felt about it and why I would make such a piece. And they asked me a little bit about my history. And when I went through college, on diving scholarships, and I had competed for a number of years. After I finished competing for Irvine, I had an opportunity to join a water circus that traveled around in Japan for about 5 months. And I'd always wanted to go to Japan because I'd trained with a fellow who was a 10-meter platform diver from Japan, and I loved it and loved the culture. So we traveled all over, and we spent a week in Hiroshima. And I had an opportunity to go to Ground Zero and see the peace park that Noguchi had created, and also go to the Peace Park Museum that documented the bomb and the blast, and I stood there and looked across the grass at Ground Zero, this concrete building that had twisted rebar, and tried to imagine that moment and the absolute horror that took place at that time, and I never forgot it. I never forgot it, and I never forgot the images that I saw in the museum. And when I was in New York and later met Noguchi, I told him that I'd been there and I'd seen his work and how much that Peace Park and the images that I'd seen meant to me, and what a long-lasting impression it made on me. And he was, you know, thankful. And so when the Japanese contacted me, they were expecting a person that was completely unsympathetic to the Japanese people and the victims of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And instead they got a person that had been there and was sympathetic, and they kept asking me over and over again. I mean, I answered their questions in advance, but they asked me if they could ask me more questions, and they were all focused on, why would you do this? How would you? Why? And I brought my answer to read, and I think that it seems pertinent. And so the question was, what motivated you to make the Fat Man sculpture? And my answer was, I wanted to make a sculpture that represented the most powerful object in the world. Nuclear weapons are the darkest, heaviest, most powerful objects I could think of. They're also the objects that most countries covet. I thought the Fat Man bomb represented the image of what most people recognize as the atom bomb, even though it was the second bomb that was dropped. Sometimes the focus of an artwork is to create a discussion that makes people contemplate their personal values and opinions. And the sculpture has been successful in that regard. The sculpture is black lacquer on wood and looks solid from the front, yet open from the side. It looks very lightweight, like a kite, yet it's a model of one of the heaviest objects and subjects possible. It represents an object of horror, yet it is beautiful. Two very conflicting states. I meant it to be a contradiction on many levels, to create more associations and a larger discussion. Even though the subject of the sculpture is a model of the Fat Man atomic bomb, I feel that the object itself is neutral. The opinions about it, however, are not neutral. They concern the moral issues related to the use of nuclear weapons, both in the past and in the future. And another question was, how do the atomic victims and their families in Hiroshima and Nagasaki feel when they see your Fat Man sculpture? Do you have a comment? As far as I know, none of the victims or family members have seen my sculpture. I would hope that they would appreciate it as an attempt to make atomic weapons real to the people that see them as something that's abstract, distant, and not really anything that concerns them. And I think that that's something that's really true of the whole atomic situation, is that it's become something that's like television. It's distant, and it's not real. And with my Fat Man bomb, I had to make the bulkheads light. I couldn't make them solid, so I turned them into these shapes that look like pulleys or possibly clock parts or possibly turbines. And I tried to have the piece be something that had references to other things. But I tried to make it something that was tangible and real and something that people could actually walk up to and realize that, yes, they are very much tangible and real, and they're not something that's over there somewhere, which I think is pretty much the world in which we live in. Does anyone have any questions or anything concerning these pieces? I think that let's see. That pretty much concludes my talk. I appreciate all of you for coming tonight. And
in the beginning, if you threw it off the intersection in the 26th block, how did you find the taxi cab driver?
It had a sign on the back of it that said, "Return and condition is found. Reward $20. It was in the days when $20 was $60. But the taxi cab driver brought it back. We talked. He came up and we had bagels and cream cheese and coffee. And we visited for quite a while. And it was a really great experience. And I was convinced that the piece was going to land on the top of a building somewhere. Or, you know, maybe I'd never see it again. And I actually had a bet with my friend that I bet that we'd find it, and he bet that we wouldn't. And it luckily hit the taxi cab, which I was really fascinated by and happy about. And I still have the plane. So anyway, that concludes my talk tonight, and I appreciate all of you for coming, and I hope that you enjoyed what you saw.